As we start the book, I want to start with a story. And part of this is slight conjecture, filling in some holes and things, but I think a lot of it comes from bits and pieces that we can find through the book of Matthew. But if we think about the man Matthew, and somewhere in the vicinity of either 60 or maybe a little after 70 AD, some people think just before the destruction of Jerusalem, some people think after, sitting down at a desk to start writing. Now, his background was he was a Jew. He'd been raised in the very strong tradition of the oral rabbis and the oral tradition of his time. And he knew his history. Clearly, he had studied the Old Testament prophets and had probably had them drilled into his head as a child. Could quote many of the same things that the people around him could quote. But his history was such that maybe there was some doubts in his mind as to what's going to happen or what's going to come. Because while we know that Israel had been this blessed and promised land, while we know that there were great promises given to Abraham as a people, while we know that David and Solomon in their heyday, what a great kingdom that they had, conditions weren't quite that decent as he grew up. And in fact, he knew the history, but you know, as we come along, even as we've studied recently in our study of Jeremiah, of the fall of Judah and of the last kings that really reigned and then were hauled off into captivity. And then when they were to come back from captivity, never again to really be a strong people, never again to really have a strong ruler, always under somebody's thumb. There's the Syrians in the north, and there's the Ptolemies and the Egyptians in the south. Wars all over the place. And not too long before he was born, maybe 30 years or so before he's born, the Romans come in and they take over. And life hasn't been just the greatest thing in the world since the Romans came. Of course, it hasn't been that great for a long time, maybe 400 years. And as he grew up, this man was clever. He was good with numbers. Probably good at memorizing things, had a good memory. But your options when you're growing up in Galilee, maybe by the Sea of Galilee or somewhere in that area, you're either going to be a farmer or a fisherman. And there's just not a lot of jobs that pay a lot or do a lot unless you try to work for the Romans. Now, that's a hard thing to do because your people, they're not really appreciative of the Romans. And if you take a job with them, well, you know you're going to catch some flack over it. But it was good work. And even though he had the background as a Jew, he decided that he'd go to work for Herod. Not Herod the Great. Well, he's not so great to a lot of the Jews there. Sure, he sort of built a temple. He's sort of acting like he's a king, but he's not really Jewish. But his son, Herod Antipas. And going to be a tax collector. You know what a tax collector is? Everybody like the IRS? No one likes the IRS, right? Internal Revenue Service. Well, guess what? You'd like them Roman tax collectors even less. Because Rome is going to put a levy on Herod and say, your area owes this much in taxes. And how's Herod going to collect it? Well, he gets his tax collectors out. And this fella had a booth, probably close to the seashore there. Who's he collecting taxes from? He's collecting them from his people. And that's what he did, was sat in this booth and collect taxes and kept tallies and kept lists and figured out who had and hadn't paid. And his income is by getting a little over what he's supposed to collect. And that's how he makes his money. But it's a job. Until that day that everything changed. And there was this rumors of all these things going on in Israel, all these great events. And hope had been kind of low for 400 years. No one had heard of any great things happening. But suddenly there's the rumors of miracles of this man who's born in that area, who's one of us, who is doing these things, and everybody's hearing about it. And then he comes by one day, stares you in the eye, and says, let's go. Follow me. And life just wasn't the same after that, because the events that started happening and all of the things, 3 years of sort of crammed education, of one of the on-the-job training in a rabbinical sense, and then losing the master, and then years of, you know, trying to remember everything that he said and everything that he did, and to let everybody else know the great message. And then, when you're about, oh, late 50s, early 60s, somewhere like that, about my age, to have to sit down and say, I got to write this down. Now, maybe I've had some notes and some other things along, but it's time to write the story. And the story you really want to be one that you can tell to all of those that you grew up with, that were your brothers and sisters in the land, and that were part of you. And say, that's the message that Matthew wanted to get across. You see how he had his training. You see how things went through. And here was a man then who had to sit down and write the message. And so as we look at Matthew, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of the introductions and things and how I got some of the pieces of the story there. But I think we understand then that even though he's writing, in a sense, his story, who's the story really about? It's about Jesus, right? And that is his story. That became his life. And so he writes it with a passion. And I think you'll see that as we start going through the book. Now, one of the things that I'm not going to do a lot of in the class over the next few weeks is I have this tendency to be the cataloging engineer type person, right? When you look at how many Gospels do we have? We have four Gospels, right? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And one of my favorite books for a long time was The Harmony of the Gospels, when I was studying the Gospels. Because that way you could get everything all pieced together, right? Because some of them are different orders, and there's all these different things going on. And the engineer in me wants to get it all chronological and exactly what had happened and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I'll give you a hint. Matthew's probably not very chronological. There's some argument as to who's the most chronological. Is it Mark or is it Luke? I kind of favor Luke because I think Luke was a historian, but lots of people think Mark was. But the chronology isn't the story that Matthew's trying to tell. And so what we need to do, I think, in this class, we're going to try to just pretty much stick with Matthew. We may have to bring in a little bit from someplace else, but I want to stick with Matthew's story and see it through his eyes as we go through this. And a harmony class we can do some other time to put them all together or something. But let's take a look at it from Matthew's standpoint. So we start looking at this, and I apologize for not having some handouts this time, not having made the decision soon enough on which way I was going. There's a little bit of lag between me getting some of my notes out. But I'll get them out. We'll get some handouts, and I'll put them on my website again and give you the link so you can download them. This is an early quote. Back in, in addition to having the writings that we consider inspired, there are some interesting writings from the 1st, 2nd, 3rd centuries of people like this fellow named Irenaeus. He lived around 130 to 202 A.D. He studied under Polycarp, who studied under John. Why is that important? Why does that make a hill of beans a difference? He's really close to the original sources, right? So when this guy says something, and he says, I learned it from Polycarp, and Polycarp learned it from John, and even though there's a very heavy oral tradition there, they tried to hand things down from generation to generation to be accurate. And we'll see a lot of this in Matthew, in this heavy oral tradition. Well, he says that Matthew issued a written gospel among the Hebrews in their own dialect while Peter and Paul were preaching at Rome and laying the foundations of the church. And after their departure, Mark, the disciple and interpreter of Peter, did also hand down to us in writing what had been preached by Peter. And Luke also, the companion of Paul, recorded in a book the gospel preached by him. And afterwards, John, the disciple of the Lord, who had also leaned on his breast, did himself publish a gospel during his residence at Ephesus in Asia. So here we have someone who's referencing all four of the gospels. But of course, he lists Matthew first. But we have there then that the gospels were important in the early church. These people looked at them. But one of the things people look at and say, okay, well, you compare Matthew and Mark, about 90% of the content in Matthew is the same as what's in Mark. But Matthew's a pretty short book. And one of the interesting things about it is Matthew's always, almost always, a little terser. He's a little shorter, kind of abridged. And a lot of people will say, well, that shows that Mark was the original source and that Matthew derived from that. And a lot of people think that. They're both inspired men, so I'm not going to argue about who wrote from who and who had notes and didn't and whatnot. But a lot of the earlier folks thought that Matthew was first. And there's some earlier quotes, and we'll get to one of those in just a second, about Matthew being first and having been originally written in Hebrew. Now, that's kind of weird because all the manuscripts that we have are in Greek. And it's really good Greek. I don't know Greek, but the people who know Greek tell me that's really good Greek. It doesn't show signs of being translated. Also possible that Matthew was bilingual. You know, he wrote the first one in Hebrew and then wrote his own translation in Greek. That could have explained all of this as well. So a lot of this we don't really know exactly. But what we do have is lots of copies of very good manuscripts in Greek so that we don't have a lot of worries about the textual accuracy of the book of Matthew. It tells its story. Papias is this fellow that wrote five volumes very close to the time of about 100 AD. So now we're getting really close to the source. But we don't have his books. But we have references to his books. It gets kind of complicated. But this is related by Papias, and it's wrote down by Eusebius in about 300 AD, that Matthew said that Matthew collected the oracles in the Hebrew language and each interpreted them as best he could. Now, the oracles there is that same word, Logos or Logos, how you want to pronounce it, either way you want to go. It's kind of like Brothers Karamazov or Karamazov or whatever. But it's the word. We talk about the word. Now, what does that mean? Is that just like the sayings of Jesus, or is this everything about him? Take your pick. What he's doing is he's collecting all of this information. And I think that's part of the point there of my story to begin with, is at some point he sat down and said, we've got to get all this together. We've got to get this written down for the future generations. And they were beginning to move from the oral tradition to a written tradition for a lot of this material. So it's early. And we've got people referencing Matthew. And we see that emphasis on the oral tradition. If you look over Matthew 23, verses 8 through 10, notice what Jesus is telling them there. He said, do not be called rabbi. For one is your teacher, and you are all brothers. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father who is in heaven. Do not be called master teachers, for one is your master teacher, and that is Christ. Now, I put in the master teacher part there. If you go to the New American Standard, the ESV, and several other translations, you might see instructor, you might see any number of different words that are there. But it really boils down to, if you put out a phrase, is like the master teacher. Who was the master teacher? Christ. It was Jesus. And he's telling them, the rabbi, they were the ones who were the ones that, that people followed, that you would sign up to be a student of the rabbi, right? Well, if we want to be students today, are we going to be a student of Matthew? We're going to study Matthew, but is that the same as being one of Matthew's students? Who do we want to be a student of today? Christ, just like they were, right? We want to be a student of theirs. And so we'll take the words from all of these others, but we're really trying to be students of Christ. And I think this deals with a lot of that oral tradition that they had. A lot of the sayings of Jesus, if you look at them, there's a lot of emphasis on parallelism, on structure, and on things that make it easier to memorize. People did memorize a lot of this. Why would you have to memorize a lot of things back then? Paper and pen were expensive. They didn't have the printing press. And it was also very laborious to write all this stuff down. I think the reason Matthew is fairly short is because it just takes a long time to write that stuff down. I want you to sit down sometime and hand copy the book of Matthew and see how long you last, right? And no fair, you can't get on your keyboard. And if you can type, I used to be able to type about 60 words a minute. That I could do that in a few hours maybe. But handwriting? Yeah. But that's the way it was conveyed, right? And so when we look at this and this tradition that they had, he's trying to put it down. And in verse 28, 19 to 20, we get the one little addition to the Great Commission here that Matthew puts in that's emphasized that's not in the others if you look at the parallel passages. Anybody recognize it? Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and Son and the Holy Spirit. We see that in each of the instances where he talks about the Great Commission. But it's Matthew that adds what? Teaching them to observe all things. We've got to follow along in this tradition of teaching. Matthew was taught. Matthew became a teacher. Not the great teacher, but a teacher. And this book is his laying down for us to capture the importance of those experiences. Just another interesting quote to talk about how they felt about oral tradition. This was Papias, the guy at 100 AD or so. If anybody came into town that knew anything about what he classes as the presbyters, whether Andrew or Peter or Philip or Thomas or James or John or Matthew, and he lists all of these people, these were like his heroes, right? And if anyone had been in their presence, anyone had heard them speak, he wanted to sit at their feet and listen to what they had said. And he said, you know, I'd rather do that than pull out 100 books. I'm a bookworm, I admit it. I enjoy reading books. But I tell you, it's a rare experience and a wonderful experience that if you've ever been able to go to a lecture for somebody who wrote a book, you get a very different experience there. And I've been able to do that a few times. And it's really, it makes you understand what this guy says when you're able to go someplace and listen to someone. Because sometimes in the writing, sometimes we as the readers don't always get the right inflection in. We don't want to put things in there. But the Gospels are written in such a way that we can collect it, we can get it out. But I think that's why we have to concentrate on the story and try to get it in our imagination, and try to figure out how they were living, what they were doing, and how this story unfolded for Matthew and how he's telling it for the rest of the world. So we got the story of Matthew. And a little bit about who he was. We've already talked about it a little bit. He was a tax collector. One of the things I said, he was probably good with figures. Do we have any parables or any stories that talk about money in the Gospels? Anybody think of any? What's that? There's several of them, right? Yeah. Well, so we got to name some. What do we got? Okay, we got the talents, the parable of talents. What else? Okay, we got the debtor. How about, do your disciples pay the poll tax? Okay, yeah. There's several instances like that. Guess where they all are? They're in Matthew. So Matthew's the one who comes up with the numbers and the figures. When Judas betrayed Jesus, how much was he paid? 30 pieces of silver. How do we know that? Because Matthew. Matthew was the one, I mean, because you can kind of see this, can't you then? If he's the guy that was the tax collector and was good at numbers and things like that, he'd keep track of that. That's just part of his second nature. And he gives us those details as we go through. So he likely worked for Herod Antipas. What's Herod Antipas famous for? Who did he kill? John the Baptist. Okay? That was probably Matthew's employer. Up to a certain point, right? I think it would have been hard for Matthew to maintain his position as a tax collector once Jesus did that, come follow me. But we also see an interesting thing. In Mark and Luke, where it's talking about that call, when Jesus was coming and calling his disciples, they don't call him Matthew. They call him Levi. And I think that shows that Matthew is kind of the author here. He puts his own name in. Okay, Levi was probably a second name of some sort. Why would they put Levi in there, perhaps, instead of Matthew for the other Gospels? Maybe we'd really rather not say that one of our group was a tax collector. I don't know. But they do call him a tax collector there. But when his list, you know, on the list of the disciples, and it gives the 12 listening, his name Matthew is there in that list, but in the list in Matthew's version, it says Matthew the tax collector. So I don't think Matthew was ashamed of what he had been. It was part of his life. It's part of where he came from. And he's got no bones about it. It also, he entertained people at his house. If you look at the story of the call in Mark and Luke, afterwards, it says that they went to the Levi's house. And that's where, remember, when the Pharisees accused him of consorting with all of those sinners and publicans? What's a publican? Tax collector. Yeah. Okay. Well, that was at Levi's house, Matthew's house. That was part of the initial introduction that Matthew had to our Lord. And I think I gained from that. If Matthew had said, okay, I'm going to give it up and I'm going to go follow you, what's the first thing that he did? He invites all of his friends to his house. And he invites Jesus in too. And he says, I got somebody you need to meet. That's why they were all at Jesus' house. I mean, at Matthew's house. Because Matthew had invited them there. Invite them to meet. Keep that in mind for Wednesday nights, okay? Invite people in. So, that's the man who wrote this. But I also want to look at this as probably one of the best bridges between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Both Jewish and Christian scholars generally label Matthew as the most Jewish of the Gospels. What do you mean by that? It's not like John, where when John talks about the Jews, it's almost always in a scathing negative sense. That's sort of the antithesis of Matthew. Now, does Matthew get tough on certain parts of the Jewish population? The Pharisees, for example, and others? Yeah, he does. But in general, what he's talking to are the people like himself that grew up in that area who had a hope and wanted to see that hope fulfilled. And he wants to bring them in. And how do you bring in that group and show them that the hope of Israel has been fulfilled? That the Messiah has come. What do you do? Well, you better go back and show them from the Old Testament scriptures, right? And so Matthew is the one that contains the most references to Old Testament scriptures of any of the Gospels. Over 90. And in fact, a whole bunch of those are very explicit in their reference to this is fulfilled. And we'll see a slide next. Some of them are kind of general, where it says, you know, all of this took place, that it might be fulfilled, and, you know, it doesn't specifically give you which passage he's referring to, and you can go back and find lots of them. But there are others where it does get very specific. Probably can't read it, but I'll publish this, and you can take a look at it later. But here's ones that I like, because I was just going through, and I just did a little, you know, you search, and it says search on fulfill, or if you've got one of the ones where you can put a star on it, so it's fulfillment, all those kind of things. Look at the list, where he's specifically saying, this took place to fulfill what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet. This is what was written by the prophet. This was spoken through Jeremiah. This was spoken or referred to by Isaiah. And he goes down, and look at all of the ones that he references. Isaiah, Micah, Hosea, Jeremiah. We've got Zechariah down at the bottom, and David in the Psalms. He's pulling from a wide range of sources here in the Old Testament. Why is he doing that? What's the point of saying, this is in direct fulfillment of this passage? Jesus is the Messiah. And he wants to make sure he hammers that point home. And so that's one of his goals. When you look and we start looking at Matthew, that Jesus is the Messiah. And you can be a good Jew, steeped in the Jewish religion, firmly believing in the Torah, firmly believing in all that God laid down in the books of Moses and in the prophets thereafter, and yet still what? Believe in Jesus Christ. Add that to it. That's the next piece. And you see, that was the breaking point for a lot of the Jews in his age. Is making that one leap to go past Moses as the only lawgiver. And getting to that point where they accepted Jesus as the Messiah. And Matthew's a great bridge for that in showing people. Now, does that mean that it's not of any use to Gentiles? If that were the case, we wouldn't be studying Matthew right now. I don't know of too many of us that have much Jewish heritage. But in a way, we do, right? Aren't we supposed to be spiritual Israel? What does that mean? But to know where our spiritual forefathers came from and know about them and know about these things like fulfillment of prophecy in the Old Testament. So the format is interesting because with that study and with the way it says this is fulfilled by that and all those kinds of things, if you do any study in some of the Jewish writings like the Talmud and the Mishnah, you'll see that they use a very similar kind of format. It's called Midrash. And that can take various forms, but Matthew is very Midrash looking. That's pretty neat because the Jewish people at that time would have recognized that and would have recognized the form of his teaching. It would not have been foreign to them. It would have been something they were comfortable with. But it clearly demonstrates his conviction in the Old Testament passages. Now, the next thing that's really hard that I always try to do is I try to write an outline for a book. And I'm not finished with Matthew yet because you either wind up with this really long outline that just says everything that's going on anyway, and it's about as long as the book, or you wind up with something too short that really doesn't capture it right. And I think there's a reason for that. Now, there's some things that people point out. There's five great discourses in Matthew. You can't pick up a commentary without it talking about the five great discourses in Matthew. What's a discourse? Yeah, I'm doing a discourse, right? That's somebody who stands up and says a rather lengthy speech. And so we have five of those great ones recorded. Now, is that the only sayings of Jesus? No. I mean, if you get your red letter edition out and you compare how many red letters are in Matthew versus the red letters in the other ones, there's a lot more in Matthew. Now, the others clearly have a lot of sayings of Jesus. No, I'm not saying they don't. But Matthew really brings it out. He's really going for putting down what Jesus said and getting these statements and quotes from Jesus out in front of people. Why was that important? Jesus is the authority, right? Here we have the man who was the master teacher, and he didn't write his own book. You know, everybody today who wants to be known, well known in a particular field, what do they got to do? Yeah, you got to write your book, right? And if you don't write your book, then, well, you must not have been that great on it. Jesus didn't even write his own book, but he left it to these other men to write it, to write the story. And so when you try to characterize that, well, there's a couple of turning points, major turning points. Verse 4 and 17, you see these phrases like, from that time on. And you see that when he, at the end of his temptation, when he begins his ministry. From that time on, Jesus began to preach and to teach. And then there's this turning point where he tells his disciples, and it's getting close, folks, I'm going to die. And he predicts his own death. And from that time on, things were a little different because they were in that last stage and they were having to just cram because that time was coming close. But is that the structure of Matthew? I don't think so. I mean, those are neat things, and there are interesting points to point out, but it's not really the structure of Matthew. So here's what I've come up with. It's a story. It's a biography, right? It's the story of Jesus. That's what Matthew's trying to tell. Turn over to Matthew 1 and verse 1. Ken, do you have that back there? Would you read that for me? Matthew 1 and verse 1. That's an easy start, right? The book of the genealogy of who? Jesus Christ. What's Christ the Greek form of for the Hebrew word? What's the equivalent? Messiah. Okay, that wasn't a name, that was a title. Jesus the Messiah is what he's saying. That's what he opens with. So you know right away what Matthew's purpose is, right? Right there in the first line. But then he calls two names out in that first verse. What are the two names that he calls out? Son of Abraham and the son of David. Why pick those two? Okay, they put a lot of stock in them, definitely. What else? The promises, right? Because it was first to Abraham, that it was to Abraham through his seed all the nations of the earth would be blessed. And Jesus is the son of Abraham. And how about David? What was the promise to him? One from his throne would reign. And Jesus was the fulfillment of that promise. So two of the most important promises to the Jewish people were to Abraham and to David. And then that title, the Messiah, the one who was going to come to save them all. All three, right there. Matthew 1:1. That's what Matthew's about. So, what do we have? We've got the beginning, the origin of Jesus, his birth, a little bit about his infancy. Then we got a big section on his ministry. And then there's a section that covers the Passion Week, the week during which he was basically turning the world on its ear there in Jerusalem and wound up getting himself crucified. And then the very short end. You ever notice 28? This is, the end of it is very short. What is that? The triumph, the resurrection. Now that's the story of Matthew. So as we look through that, I want you to keep that in mind as we go through. So Matthew chapter 1, let's take a look there. And the first thing he does is a genealogy, and I will not read all of the names. But I do want to point out some names. Most of you probably read through this, I hope. Any names in here who kind of jump out at you? There's some unusual stuff in this genealogy. Okay, that's a good one. Rahab. Actually, how many women are listed? There's three women listed. Well, three women of interesting report. There's a couple of others listed, yeah. But three names to me that stick out on the ladies. What are those? Rahab. Tamar first. Yeah, you got Tamar. And then Ruth. And then Rahab. Okay, Mary's down there a ways. What's interesting about Tamar being in the list? Yeah, that was kind of an illicit relationship there, right? And then we've got Ruth. She's not even Jewish, is she? She's a Moabitess. And then we've got Rahab. The innkeeper. As it's kindly stated in some places, right? Why are they listed? Why are they there? I mean, someone who's really wanting to put the vaulted heraldry sigils on the, you know, on the wall of your ancestors and all of their great deeds, is that what you would want listed in your genealogy? So why are they there? I think so, yeah. I think there's a couple of things that everyone's going to be included here at some point, right? And there were sinners. Were there good folks and bad folks in this list? Yeah, there's all over. But there's one other thing that Matthew's going to have to deal with, and that's Mary, right? Because Mary is betrothed to Joseph when they find out she's pregnant. That was a bit of a scandal. Bit of a scandal. But were scandals unknown in the genealogy? No. And in fact, in each of these cases, even with Tamar, what did Judah finally say after he kind of found out what was done? She's more righteous than I was on this. Right? And Rahab? Anybody going to second guess Rahab and her faith and what she did? I don't think so. And how about Ruth? There are actually three great women that are listed there. Even though there might have been the equivalent of some sort of scandal around it, you got to be careful with that, that you know what the facts are and what all the background are and what's going on there before people just label things a scandal. And I think that would have applied to Mary as well. Now, if you go on down in verse 17, he says, therefore, all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the time of Christ, 14 generations. He lists 14 in each case. There's one case where you got to fill one name in. He's got 14 that you list here for the first ones. But where does he start in his genealogy? Abraham. Ah, but you see, that's consistent with verse 1, isn't it? Because Abraham was the one of the promises, and that's where we're starting if we're going to relate the promises. Luke's got another big, long genealogy. There are parts of it that are very similar to this, parts of it that are different. And one of the things that a lot of Bible naysayers will say is, okay, you got two Gospels, two supposedly inspired works, and two different lists. How do you figure that? Yeah, I think so we're looking at whose genealogy is whose. And in this, if you're going to be in the line of David, who's the line you got to follow? Yeah, your father on earth, father or stepfather or whatever you want to call him there, got to be in the line, right? And if you look at the very end of it, and it said, and Jacob was born Joseph, the husband of Mary. He's been given the line down to Joseph. Did that mean that if Christ wasn't really Joseph's son physically, that he was not in the line there? Turns out Mary was too. Got both sides of it there. The point is as a male in that line, he was in the line of the kings. Now, you notice the sort of downfall there. If you know a little bit of history and you've read some of the Old Testament history, some of those names in the first part, they're probably familiar, right? You start with Abraham, who's next? Everybody can quote those without even looking. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, who's next? Judah, okay. Kind of falls apart after there for a lot of folks, but that's fine. You read these names, you recognize them. How about when you start with David and you go down? You got David, then you got Solomon, then you got Rehoboam, and you recognize all those names of kings, right? Now, one of the things that's interesting, where I told you about the 12-13 deal, it says, and to Josiah was born Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. Jeconiah was not Josiah's son. Jehoiakim, Jeconiah is Jehoiakim. And Jehoiakim was the one that was the son, and Jehoiakim was the grandson of Josiah. But if you stick Jehoiakim in there, then you get the 14 count on the next list. So little hiccup there in the terms of the way we look at it, but he clearly states he means for 14 generations to be each one. Now, in this last set, from verses 12 to 16, how many names in there do you recognize? Yeah, we should get Zerubbabel. He's pretty close there. You know, might not remember Shealtiel, but it shows us that Zerubbabel's in the line, right, when he came back to lead the return from captivity as one of the governors there. But very quickly after that, the names become, well, they're just not. Why aren't we familiar with these names? 400 years of silence. That's why we're not familiar with these names. There weren't any records that we have in the book here for that time period. But he lists them down, which means that when that list was gone, they had access to their genealogies and things, right? He could know these. And probably they were still memorized and passed down. And that's why there would be certain numbers of them, so they could memorize them and pass them down. And you get all the way down to Joseph. Those are all the generations. I think sometimes we don't understand how important it was for them to make sure that that was the case. We do things differently in this country, right? How important is the genealogy of any of our presidents? We don't even know what the genealogy is for most of our presidents, right? Other than if they get Jeb Bush to run, that's going to be probably a record, right, with that many Bushes having been involved in presidency. But that's another story, maybe. And what's that? There you go. That's the only thing that's got to be there is they got to be native-born Americans according to the Constitution, right? That's it. That's the qualification, not who their dad was or whatever. What was the qualification for being king in Israel? Direct descendant of David. Otherwise, you weren't qualified. Right? So, now we have it. We've got the Messiah. He's a direct descendant of David. He's also a direct descendant of Abraham. We're in place. We're ready to go. And we get to the point where it says, and now, the birth of Jesus was like this. Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's true even with this. The genealogies would skip. I mean, this is not the complete genealogy.
No, it's not the complete list.
But he breaks down much into 14. He does that for a purpose. He excludes some for that reason. But this skipping of some and not including people in the genealogy is very common Jewish practice. But I think that he's making a point there about 14.
There's lots of places where Matthew does some tidy things that are designed, that are numbers. And we'll talk about some of those as we go along. He likes the number 7, just like John liked the number 7. Okay, there's 7 woes in a certain place, and there's 7 attributes that he has for people that he lists, and there's 7 pairs and comparisons in the Sermon on the Mount. So the number 7 crops up multiple times. The number 5 crops up multiple times in places. Each of those had some meanings. We've talked about them in previous classes. So, yeah, thank you for bringing that out again. So as he's listing these generations, it's not that that was the exact number and that there's no people missing in there. That was one of the problems that Bishop Unger had when he was trying to put the genealogies together, is when it said somebody was the son of, they might be the grandson or the great-grandson or whatever. That just meant the direct descendant of. But he picks these names on purpose as ones that would have been familiar, I think, to most of the folks that were looking at this list. And then he splits it up into that time period so that I think there's another reason for that, because when you look at that first time period from Abraham to David, what do we call that period? That's the patriarchs, right? Those are the folks that had the original promise to Abraham and were passing that along. That's the patriarchs. And then when you go from David to the Babylonian captivity, what period is that? That's the kings, right? You know, we got the United Kingdom, the divided kingdom. It doesn't try to make that sense. But so we got the patriarchs and we got the kings. And then what do we have? Infamy. We've got 400 years of pain and suffering and not getting our promises and not knowing if God is going to talk to us again. And that's the periods. And what comes at the end of that period when they don't know if God's going to talk to them again or not? You get the carpenter who says, come follow me, right? And so that's why Matthew's breaking it down. He's reminding them of their history as well as their genealogy. Multiple purposes here. Okay, so then when he gets down to the birth, and we got about 2 minutes to cover the birth part. Luckily, that's just a couple of verses here. The birth of Jesus was as follows. When his mother Mary had been betrothed to Joseph before they came together, she was found to be with child by the Holy Spirit. And I think that's one of the reasons we have that reference back to some of the other women, is this is not an unusual thing. Yes, it is unusual, right? This is not in the same vein as the other one, but it has the potential to be a scandal like the others were, but it's not. Joseph, her husband, being a righteous man and not wanting to disgrace her, desired to put her away secretly. So he's dealing with the scandal, right? People may have heard this story. You know, can you imagine that when somebody's trying to say this, Jesus is the Messiah, he's the Savior of mankind, and somebody goes, wait a minute, I heard this thing about when he was born, you know, and his mom, you know, she was like pregnant before they got married. I just don't think this is going to work. Can you see that happening? Yeah. But no, this is what Matthew deals with there. So he says, no, that was the plan by the Holy Spirit. And Joseph, being righteous, he doesn't want to make a scandal over this, right? But then what does he do? It says, but when he had considered this, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife, for that which has been conceived in her is of the Holy Spirit, and she will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for it is he who will save his people from their sins. Now, all this took place that what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet might be fulfilled, saying, behold, the virgin shall be with child and shall bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which translated means God with us. There we go, first chapter, and what's he already doing? He's already made reference to Abraham and David. And now he's got the scandal to deal with, and how does he deal with it? He quotes Old Testament scripture and says, this is exactly what was supposed to happen when it says in the book of Isaiah that a virgin will be with child. Now, how many people do you think had copies of the book of Isaiah sitting on their bookshelves at home, or in that case, scrolls? Nobody. How many people do you think were familiar with a passage like this, though? Everybody, because they heard it regularly, and they heard it read regularly. So they knew these passages. And so when Matthew brings these up, as we go through the story of Matthew, and he brings these up, keep in mind that while we may have the written word, they had a strong oral tradition. They knew these words that he's bringing up. And so this would have been very familiar to them. All right, we'll pick up chapter 2 next week.